Most of our plans as we look ahead to the things we'd like to do, things we'd like to take care of, things we want to accomplish, we base our plans on the expectation that things are going to remain pretty much the same as they have been. As we observe the Feast of Tabernacles this year, we'll be coming home and looking forward to a number of winter activities. We have the Winter Family Weekend, which many of you attend every year. We'll be getting into our teen speech club. Many of you have been part of that for several years. Others will be joining us. Then we start looking forward to the spring holy days and observance of the Passover, the days of unleavened bread. The weather begins to break, and we look forward to another summer and the activities, the opportunities, maybe some plans you have for what you'd like to do next summer. And, of course, another Feast of Tabernacles. In fact, you'll probably begin planning for 2020 Feast while you're at the Feast this year, if you haven't already. Of course, there are times when life does get interrupted, even though we make our plans and look forward. They get interrupted by unanticipated changes or trials that come along. But for the most part, in general, we plan day to day and live day to day as if our future will be the same as our past. And that pretty much has been the case. Many of you have been part of the church and the cycle of this way of life for many, many years. The festivals we observe this time of year establish our basic understanding of Bible prophecy, which reminds us that there will come a time when things will not continue into the future as they have done in the past. There will be a time of sudden, dramatic, and permanent change. The patterns, the rhythms, the routine, the expectations of life as we know it will come to a sudden end and ultimately be replaced by something entirely different. And it's not going to be a slow and subtle change. It will come about suddenly, even violently, and will catch most of the world totally by surprise. When his disciples asked Jesus questions about the end of the age, he described those events that would lead to it in mostly general terms. And he warned his disciples that even though they could not know when exactly it would take place, they were always to be prepared for it. In the last sermon I gave, we reviewed part of the answer that Jesus gave to their question. We read Matthew 24, verses 4 through 8, and we compared that to the first six or so verses in Revelation chapter 6. And we saw that what Jesus revealed in his answer to the disciples was the same as the first four seals that are opened in this scroll of prophecy. We also realize that while the conditions that Jesus described in Matthew 24 have generally been happening ever since his time, Revelation shows us that these parallel prophecies along that same line will have a much greater and more intense fulfillment at the time of the end of the age. Let's go back to Matthew 24. After answering the disciples' questions about the sign of his return, Jesus gave a parable. Matthew chapter 24, we'll drop down to verse 45. Just look at a couple of verses here in this parable, chapter 40, verses 45 and 46 in Matthew 24. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. This is a parable, of course, and in this parable, he gives an example of a master who gives his servants responsibilities, and they were to care for the household and for each other until the master returned. And when he did, he expected to find his servants faithfully carrying out their responsibilities. This lesson has a clear and an obvious lesson that we're familiar with. Jesus left his disciples with responsibilities. And he tells his disciples that while we cannot know exactly when he will return, he expects that when he does return, he will find his disciples fulfilling the responsibilities he'd given to them. The title of the sermon this morning is So Doing When Jesus Returns. In the parable, the servants of this household are to continue their assigned tasks over a prolonged period of time, even though their master is not there to directly supervise them. Now, most all of you on your job at one time or another have had a day when the boss wasn't in the office or wasn't on the job. You know, people tend to kind of let down when the boss isn't right there with them. When he's not there to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, what they probably would do anyway, but it's just a little more lax when the boss isn't there. So this is a test of the faithfulness of these servants. To continue their tasks faithfully, even though their master was not there. So again, the lesson is clear. Jesus will return after a long period of time, and he expects his household, or his church, and his disciples in it, to be faithfully continuing to carry out the responsibilities that he leaves for them. Now, to be persistent and consistent over a long period of time is enough of a challenge by itself. Again, especially if the boss isn't right there. It's easy to let down a bit, take a day or two off, not be as diligent as you might be if he was right there with you. So to be consistent over a long period of time is a challenge in itself. But to make matters more difficult, Jesus indicates that his disciples will be living under extremely difficult circumstances just prior to his return. I'll pause and give you a bit of a warning. What we're going to review this morning is a part of prophecy about the end of the age that we really don't enjoy looking at. Prophecies of some worrisome and troubling times that Jesus said his disciples would face at the end of the age. But it is something that he wanted his disciples to be aware of, so they're not taken by surprise when it comes upon them. Now, as we always emphasize, we don't know when exactly the prophecies regarding the end of the age will come about. We know that they will be fulfilled, but we don't know just when. We emphasize that, but we also always remember they could happen in our time. And so we can't just ignore what Jesus warned of and expect that everything in our future will be the same as everything in our past. So let's look at these passages that Jesus offered that speak of that time to come. We read verses 4 through 8 in Matthew 24. Let's continue into verse 9. Matthew 24, verse 9. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And many will be offended and will betray one another and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. This is another of the signs that Jesus gave to his disciples of an event or things that would take place prior to his return. The severe persecution of his disciples. Turbulent and confusing times, to the extent that many, it says, will be offended, or in other words, will stumble under the pressure and difficulty of those times, the persecution that will take place. And it says they'll even turn against and betray one another. That's a pretty serious situation, and it's kind of hard to imagine as we consider the way things are now in the world we live in and the conditions in the church itself. How could those kinds of situations come about? Let's compare this to what Jesus' words are, to his words as they're recorded in Luke 21. Remember, Luke 21 is the same prophecy, but is Luke's account of Jesus' prophecy that they call the Olivet prophecy. Let's go to Luke 21. We find a few different details here. Luke chapter 21, and we'll begin in verse 12. It says, "Before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. You'll be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. But it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony or for a witness. Therefore, settle in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer. For I'll give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. You'll be betrayed, even by parents, brothers, relatives, and friends, and they'll put some of you to death. And you'll be hated by all men for my name's sake. But not a hair of your head shall be lost. By your patience, possess your souls." Now that's even more difficult a prophecy than what we read in Matthew. More detail is given about the particular kinds of challenges that his disciples will face, the opportunity they'll have to defend their faith, but it also focuses on the betrayal and the severe persecution that his disciples will face. Now many look at these prophecies and both Matthew 24 and Luke 21, and recognize that, in a sense, they have been at least partially fulfilled already. The church in the first century suffered a great deal of persecution, and the disciples and apostles in particular were called on to witness their beliefs to authorities. There was martyrdom at the hand of the Jews and the Romans, and many, because of the persecution, fled Jerusalem to find a safer place to live. So their lives were severely disrupted. They were under incredibly intense pressure. Now, in a way, for those who escaped from Jerusalem, it was a bit of a blessing in disguise, because in 69 AD, the city of Jerusalem was destroyed. It was attacked by the Roman army, and the temple itself was leveled except for one wall that still remains standing. So for some, their departure from Jerusalem, although it was under severe circumstances, was a safer place for them to be than had they been in the city. Not only was there the intense partial fulfillment that we see at that time, we know that there's been religious oppression and persecution throughout the ages. God's way of life is not part of Satan's world. And there have been different times when there have been serious persecutions that Christians have dealt with in their lives. But notice verse 18, it's almost a contradiction because it's talking about being betrayed and some of them being put to death. But he says then in verse 18, "Not a hair of your head shall be lost." There's a difference between being lost and dying. Those who are among the ones who are betrayed and who are martyred during this time may have lost their physical life, but that's a temporary thing. They're not lost. There's other verses that indicate or show that principle. Look just quickly at Matthew chapter 10, verse 27. The most painful thing for us to consider is separation by death, but God looks at that very differently. And it's not a matter of maintaining this physical life at all costs, To lose this, to die from this physical life is not a matter of being lost, because we still realize the rest, or the next part of the step in God's plan. But look at Matthew 10, verse 28. Do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. That's not talking about your body and your soul having a separate life from your body. The point is that the one that we fear is not a human being who can end this physical life, but God, or Jesus Christ, who have the authority to cause our lives to be discontinued permanently. And so we fear God, we don't fear man, and not a hair of your head shall be lost, in Luke 21, is not a promise that they wouldn't be harmed or they wouldn't die, but that their lives spiritually would still be promised. Verse 19, by your patience possess your souls. When this time comes on the disciples of Jesus Christ, in whatever age it occurred, could have been back in Jesus, shortly after Jesus' time in the first century, could have been later, when the city was attacked, the Jews were so seriously persecuted, and the Christians could have been later, as time has continued through the ages. Whatever time when these kinds of serious persecution trials come upon his disciples, it is by their patience, by their endurance, by their willingness to continue faithfully under extreme circumstances that they will be. That their lives will be saved. Really, that statement, although it's very different in the way it's put, is the exact same statement that Matthew makes, Matthew 24:13, he who endures to the end shall be saved. The endurance has to do with being strong enough to deal with that time of persecution that comes upon. Now, to the people, again, at the time that the city of Jerusalem was attacked, they probably felt that it was something that was being, that this prophecy that Jesus had given was being fulfilled. But all you have to do is look ahead in this same prophecy to verses 21 and 22, where it's clear that the prophecy is not fulfilled by what happened locally in Jerusalem, but the entire world is in jeopardy of destruction at the time that this prophecy is predicting. So it is still yet to come. Now, with these verses in mind in Matthew 21 and Luke, Matthew 24 and Luke 21, let's compare these then as well to Revelation 6. We find that this prophecy of persecution is the equivalent of the fifth seal that is opened as this scroll of prophecy is being unrolled, and each section is sealed separately. The fifth section, or the fifth seal, reveals prophecy of this same period of time. Revelation 6, verse 9, when he opened, and this is Jesus opening the seals, when he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. In other words, he saw in this vision those who had been martyred for their belief and faithfulness to God's truth and God's law. Verse 10, and they cried out with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? Then a white robe was given to each of them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer, until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren, who would be killed as they were, was completed. The martyrs from previous times are pictured in this vision, but we know, because we understand that when a person dies, they are not conscious. We know that they're not literally crying out from their graves. This is a symbolic or poetic picture of God's coming vengeance and the waiting that takes place until God does intervene to take revenge for the death of those who were killed for their belief in him. But the point to be emphasized for now is the last phrase here in verse 11, that these brethren who were in their graves would wait there until the number of those who still will be martyred is completed. There's a time yet ahead, as we saw in Matthew and in Luke, for further persecution to take place. So, of course, we ask ourselves, could this happen during our time? And it becomes very personal. If it did, would we be strong enough to remain faithful? Or would we be among those who are offended and deceived, and even begin to betray one another? Very sobering and very difficult for us to even try to imagine such a thing, because we live in a period of time where we've never experienced persecution on this level. Oh, you've probably had some family members who give you a hard time, or a boss who wouldn't let you off on the Sabbath, but persecution on this order, we, in our time, in our age, have never had to deal with such a thing. And it's hard to imagine how that even could come about. Well, we find another prophecy in Daniel 7 that gives us a little more information and shows us how, at least in general terms, how these prophecies can be fulfilled. Let's turn back to Daniel chapter 7. It's a lengthy prophecy. We're not going to go through all of it. I'm just going to touch a couple of highlights and focus on one aspect. Daniel 7 begins with the description of four beasts, four wild animals that are used to describe world-dominating empires that will begin in Daniel's time and will continue all the way through to the time of Jesus Christ's return. We can compare this to Daniel chapter 2, which gives a similar prophecy with different imagery. But the same world-dominating empires are intended by both of these prophecies. Of course, it began with Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. The next world-dominating empire described in these passages is Medo-Persia. Then came Greece, and then came Rome. So it have been four major world-dominating empires. We're going to focus on the fourth beast in this vision because it has existed in the past, and we'll see that it is yet again going to be dominating the world when Jesus returns. We'll drop down to verse 8. Well, verse 7 says, I saw in the night, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful, terrible, and exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth, devouring and breaking in pieces and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it. It had 10 horns. Let's pause and just kind of summarize here a little bit. The first three powers, as we mentioned, Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. The fourth beast that's listed here represents the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was much stronger and more destructive than the other three that came before. It has 10 horns. These horns represent a series of revivals that would continue this same beast over a period of some 1,500 years. Although the Roman Empire itself initially ended, it has had several different specific revivals. Now, I'll just pause and recommend that there's some articles on Life, Hope, and Truth that might be helpful to you. There's one entitled Daniel 7, Four Beasts and a Little Horn. There's also one titled What is Babylon? If you go to the search function on Life, Hope, and Truth and just enter the word Babylon, then you'll find a whole list of articles that review some of these prophecies. And I don't, like I said, there was far too much to go through in just one brief message. But the fourth beast is explained and described, and it is this Roman Empire, which has gone through a series of resurrections over more than 1,500 years, that is represented by the 10 horns that it's described as having. Nonetheless, verse 8, I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom the three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. Again, very symbolic language, but it is describing another authority or power, that's what a horn represents, that rises up among those 10 horns that are mentioned as well. Continue to drop down to verse 19, we find out a little more about this horn, little horn. Verse 19, I wished to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others. Now, from this point on, there's more detail given in Daniel 7 than we find in Daniel 2. More detail about this this fourth beast, and we find here the description of the authority that's within that beast that rises to prominence, this little horn. So I wanted to know more about the fourth horn. It was exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and trampled the residue with its feet. Very violent, powerful empire that destroys everything in its path. And the 10 horns which were on its head, and the other horn which came up, before which three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and mouth and spoke with pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. So this one is described as little. It is pompous, it is powerful, and it stands out over the other horns that represent more of a political aspect of the recurrence of the Roman Empire. Drop down to verse 21. As I was watching, the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came. This little horn goes to war against the saints, and it is winning. It is prevailing against God's people, and it continues until Jesus Christ returns. This little horn is allowed to persecute and oppress and dominate God's people. Verse 22, we read, drop down to verse 25. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. So again, it's descriptive of a religious power that persecutes the people of God, and it goes about changing or attempting to, effort to change God's law, to change time, to change law, to take authority in this religious sense and to dominate. And it is allowed, this power is allowed to harm and to control and give an authority over God's people. It says for a time, times, and half a time. Now that description of we understand that to be 3.5 years. A time, then times meaning two, that makes a total of three, and then half a time. That is a 3.5 year period during which this persecution or tribulation on God's people is allowed. This is the persecution that we find prophesied in Matthew 24 and Luke 21. It comes through the hands of this tenth resurrection of the Roman Empire. Now, when the Roman Empire became known as the Holy Roman Empire, when the Catholic Church began to merge with the political and military powers of Rome. It became known as the Holy Roman Empire. And the Pope had great authority over the entire empire, and this is speaking of an end-time iteration or revival of that same form of government. Go back to Revelation chapter 13. Revelation 13. Revelation 13 prophesies two beasts that rise up and dominate the world. And this time setting here, again, is shortly before the return of Jesus Christ. The first beast is described in the first 10 verses of this chapter, and it is a political military power that dominates the world scene. Notice in verse 7, it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him whose names have not been written in the book of life. So this is describing one who, through Satan, is given the authority and the power to dominate, to rule over the entire earth, and in particular to make war again with the people of God and to have to overcome them. In other words, to they will be, in a sense, defenseless against his authority and his power. And this will affect all of those. All of the world will fall to or worship this beast power except those who are God's people, those whose names are written in the book of life. As you go on into verse 11, we see a little more about the how this power comes about that this beast has. Because a second beast comes up, it says, out of the earth. It has horns like a lamb and speaks like a dragon. It's not what it appears to be, is the point of that description. It appears to be a lamb. It appears to be something that would be of God, but actually it is of Satan. It speaks like a dragon. And this beast, verse 12, exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast. So the description we read a moment ago from verse 7, that power and authority comes to the beast from this second beast, causes those to worship him. Verse 13, he performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword, that is, this beast that keeps coming back after it has seemingly been put down in the past. It was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power. This is the second beast. Then was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should cause, should speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. So in this kind of tangled symbolic language, it's describing a great religious authority which dominates a powerful military authority and forces people to worship this false image, this false representation. It forces them to worship this beast itself. This is nothing less than Satan, of course, trying to extend his rule over mankind and bring mankind under his authority. And he is given time to do that at the end of the age. And the saints of God, as we saw in Matthew 21, Matthew 24, Luke 21, Daniel 7, the people of God at that time will suffer extreme persecution. Now we remember, of course, that there also is protection that is offered or promised to the church in general. Revelation 12, verse 13. Revelation chapter 12, verse 13. This is after there's war in heaven and Satan is cast back down to the earth. Verse 13, when the dragon saw that he'd been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. He persecuted the people of God, in this case the church of God that represents Jesus Christ. But the woman, and the woman here refers to the true church, was given two wings of an eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So this same period of time, times, and half a time that Daniel mentioned as a time of great persecution, it says that the church at that point, the woman at that point, will be given protection, will be taken away out of Satan's presence and nourished and cared for that period of time. Verse 17, the dragon was enraged with the woman or with the church, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So, when we put all this together, we understand that there will be those who are protected. Sometimes people ask, does the church still believe in the place of safety? Well, the church believes in what Scripture tells us, and Scripture says that the woman will be protected and nourished from Satan's presence. So, sure, we believe that there will be protection given to the church in a general sense during this time. But likely not before, as we compare this to Matthew 24 and Luke 21, not before there is persecution that comes upon the church itself. How exactly, we want to know just how is this going to work out? You know, exactly where am I going to be? What's going to happen to me and my family? How am I going to make my escape? Where am I going to go? What's going to happen? I'll have to let someone else give that sermon. Those are questions that we ponder and that we consider, but we don't have a direct answer for them. But we do have notice in Scripture that there will be a time of severe persecution, and during that time there also will be protection offered to God's people. And this helps us to focus then on the warning that Jesus gave in Luke 21. Remember, again, Luke 21 is all of that prophecy. And at the end of this, of Luke's account, we have words of Jesus Christ that are not included in Matthew 24, at least not directly. In Luke 21:36, Jesus concludes here the Olivet prophecy by saying, "Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man." To be counted worthy, the phrase that's translated counted worthy means to escape or to flee from. Counted worthy means to be strong enough to prevail. It means to have a spiritual strength and faith that is strong enough to prevail in those difficult times. And to escape means to flee from. So, Jesus warns, and he especially warned in the preceding verses here, that we need to be careful not to be distracted by other things in our lives so that we would not be aware of or be prepared. Watching is a significant part of our life, to be watchful. And we're going to talk a little bit about that as we wrap up in a few minutes. To be watchful and to be prayerful is certainly essential to us in every age. Again, will these things happen in our time? We don't know for sure, but Jesus said it doesn't matter when it's going to happen. Every age, every Christian should be prepared and living in a way that you're prepared for these times. So, we find a number of passages that warn us of things that will happen. And these are the things that are in the background, or maybe in the foreground, of a Christian's life during this period of time. But Jesus said, as we saw in Matthew 24, that when he returns, he expects his servants to still be doing certain things, to still be living in a certain way, even in those very difficult, tortured times. So we'll conclude by reviewing what it is that we should be so doing. What is it that Jesus Christ expects us to be doing as he, when he returns, in our preparation for his return? I'll cover briefly 4 points. Well, maybe 3. The first point has, the first lesson actually has, is 3 lessons in itself. The first thing that we note that we are to be so doing follows immediately after this parable in Matthew 24. Let's go back there again. Matthew 24, we read verses 45, 46 about the responsibility that the master leaves for his servants before he goes, and he expects them to be fulfilling when he returns, to be so doing. Notice that Matthew 25 is really part of the same prophecy. There's a chapter break there, but the translators broke it up so they wouldn't have a 100-verse chapter. Matthew 24 and 25 are the same thought, they're the same message. So what we find following Jesus' warning that we must be watchful and prepared are 3 specific lessons in Matthew 25 that tell us what we need to be doing, that he needs to find us so doing when he returns. They're familiar, so we won't spend a lot of time, although you might want to reread them and personalize these lessons, project yourself into them, and see how they apply in your daily life. The first lesson is called the parable of the 10 virgins, or the 10 bridesmaids. And the story is given about how some were prepared and some were not. And those who weren't prepared had to go find quickly a way to become prepared, and it was too late by the time they had gotten the oil that they needed. So the lesson is in verse 13. The lesson that we are to apply is in verse 13. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. Notice, I would emphasize, the Son of Man is coming. There's no question about that. It is going to happen. Jesus Christ will return. We don't know when that will happen. So the familiar instruction is to watch, to be vigilant, to be diligent, and to be awake, is what the word watch means. Now we apply that to being aware of news events that are happening around the world, and that's part of it. That's essential, because Jesus did warn about some of those general trends in the first few verses of his prophecy. So we should keep track of what's happening, and we can compare general trends and events to what we understand of prophecy. So there's an element of looking at news and being aware of what's happening, but that's not fully what it means. To be watchful means to be awake, to be alert, to be vigilant, to not be distracted. Jesus warned of that in Luke 21. Don't let the cares of this life get in the way and clutter your life so that you're unaware of what is happening and of what Jesus Christ expects of you. We could take this point and expand it into a number of different directions. We could go back to Revelation 3 and read about that church at the end of the age that is called Laodicea. And that very word strikes fear in the hearts of Christians, not to become like they were. But that's a warning that Jesus Christ gave. It's a matter of growing lethargic or distracted. The first lesson of so doing is in this parable. Continue to be watchful, because we do not know when these events might occur. The second lesson in this chapter is called the parable of the talents. The parable of the talents tells us that we must be diligent in our personal growth. Our personal growth. You understand, remember the story. They were given different amounts of money, and they were told to invest the money. And when the master returned, he expected a healthy return on their investment. Two were successful, one failed. The importance of diligence and personal growth is what is emphasized. Those who succeeded, the two who doubled the amount that they were given great reward. The one who didn't do anything with it was punished severely. It's a pretty simple story, but it has huge meaning to us. We must work diligently to apply God's way in our lives for our personal spiritual growth. God has invested in us His Holy Spirit. His very life and essence and His power is given to us, and is given to us to put to work in our lives to develop the talents, the abilities, the strength that we need to have. And this was something that was touched on in the sermonette. You know, the reward that's given to those who succeed, to be that faithful servant who is rewarded for effort. We are rewarded for our works. What we do matters. Our diligence and personal growth, our effort to overcome those areas in our lives where we are deficient. It's all part of this lesson of the talents. And then finally, the third parable in this chapter, and that's something else that we are to be doing when Christ returns, is to care for and serve one another. To care for and serve one another. Again, it was a focus in the sermonette that we heard just a few minutes ago. But notice verse 40. Verse 40. When we serve and care for one another, Jesus says that we're actually caring for Him. Inasmuch as you did these things to one of the least of my brethren, you did it to me. And when we serve one another in the way that Jesus Christ intends, and show love for one another as He loved us, again, this is a principle that is not difficult to understand, and we could expand it and spend a lot of time talking about it, but the point is that Jesus expects us to be growing in unity, to be growing in love, to showing our care for one another, everyone, on every level, receiving that attention and that care. Those are things that Jesus Christ expects to find us so doing, even as perhaps we live in difficult times. Another important way something else we can do is to be firmly convicted of and grounded in God's truth. This is something that we need to be continually doing and living, that we understand and that we are devoted to the truth that God has revealed to us. And we see how precious it is, how meaningful it is, and we don't just believe certain things because the church says certain things, but we believe things for ourselves, that we understand, we prove, we apply, and we are dedicated to the truth that God has revealed to us. Turn back to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. not a lot of real specific prophetic chapters in the New Testament outside of the book of Revelation, but this is one of them. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. The people at Thessalonica were troubled, and they were being badgered by some teaching things that were not true, and they were living in a time of persecution and tribulation. And Paul writes to encourage them, to remind them of things that they had already talked about. In chapter 2, verse 1, Paul writes, "Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him." So it's very much focused on what we are concentrating on at this time of year, the time of the return of Jesus Christ. He says, "We ask you not to be shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as though the day of Christ had come." So the people there were receiving other messages from other sources, pretending to be speaking on Paul's behalf or speaking for him. They were giving false messages about the times that would come leading to the return of Jesus Christ. "Let no one deceive you by any means," he said. Remember that deception is a key element that will be troubling the disciples of Jesus Christ just before his return. These messages of deceit and confusion will multiply and become very convincing unless one is well grounded. So don't be deceived by anything. You know the order, the structure in which these things will take place. And it says, unless the falling away come first. This phrase, "the falling away," has kind of been, I think, confusing to some. Just what is it addressing? The falling away is a Greek phrase that means rebellion or abandonment. Rebellion or abandonment. So what the falling away is a deliberate change of belief. A deliberate change, an intentional abandoning of what one previously had believed. So it is talking about those who have understanding or had understanding. We would say those who had been part of God's church, but they abandon. They turn away from them. The indication, as we read the entire chapter here, is that this takes place shortly before Jesus Christ returns. In other words, this condition he's speaking of has not yet been fulfilled. Now, some go back to the 4th century when the Roman Catholic Church was established, and they consider that the time when people abandoned the truth. It certainly was a time when there was a huge change, but it doesn't seem to be the actual specific time that Paul is referring to. That's not a fulfillment of his statement. Some would go back to 1995, when the Worldwide Church of God began to fall apart, and that was the time when people abandoned the truth. Well, they certainly did. Many did walk away from what they had said that they believed. Either they didn't really believe it, or they didn't fully believe it, but at any rate, they didn't stay with it. But again, that's probably not the fulfillment of this prophecy, because as we continue, we see that Paul is writing about the time immediately preceding Jesus Christ's return. Those were times when people abandoned the truth, but it is not the time that Paul is speaking of. But it is something we can take as a warning, recognizing that there will be a time again when this is a problem for God's people, that some will turn deliberately away from the truth as that time takes place. I'm not going to have time to read through this in detail, but if you drop down to verses... let's see. Verse 7, the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. In other words, the false leader, the false, the foundation for that false teaching is already in place, but it is being held back until the time when Jesus Christ will let it occur. Verse 9, the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, with all unrighteousness and deception among those who are perishing, because they did not receive the love of the truth. So, speaking of a time yet to come when those who did not receive or maintain, those who walked away from their love of the truth, will be deceived by the wonders and the miracles that this man of sin will be performing. So, the whole picture here is of people of God being seriously challenged at the end of the age, just before Jesus Christ returns. And a lesson that we can learn, as we should be so doing, is that we must be fully convicted of and grounded in God's truth, so that we are not going to be drawn into the deception that will come, because it will be powerful. The miracles that this person will perform will be actual miracles. They're not going to be tricks, they're not going to be magic, they're going to be things that are supernatural. And people will believe that because they're supernatural, they're of God. But then truth will be the supernatural power of Satan that will be bringing about these miracles. So, we see that there are lessons for us in terms of being watchful and prepared and being diligent in our personal Christian life and development, our care and our service for one another, and our need to be firmly and solidly grounded in the truth of God, so that we're not going to be among those who could be deceived and confused. That's the personal responsibility we have. And of course, we also have the responsibility, just to touch on it briefly, to continue as a church to teach the Word of God to the end of the age, to take the gospel of God's, this gospel message to the nations where God opens doors and gives us opportunity. So it's talking about us remaining structured, working together, and supporting the work that is being done in preaching the gospel. And that is part of what Jesus Christ will find his people doing when he returns. Let's go back to Daniel 7 to conclude. Daniel chapter 7. I mentioned at the outset that these are not prophecies that we enjoy thinking about or focusing on, but they're important for us to recognize because they are part of the future. Again, part of the future. When is a question, but it's not a question that requires an answer, because Jesus answered that question saying that his disciples would always be ready, would always be so doing, and certainly would be at the time of his return. Daniel 7, beginning in verse 27, at the end of all this time of persecution and difficulty that come about through the fourth beast, it says, then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, to the saints of the Most High. For all the suffering that God's people will endure at the end of the age, for all the suffering that God's people have endured throughout the ages, they will be part of that first resurrection that Paul wrote of, and they will be the greatness and of the kingdom and under all of the heavens, the whole earth, will be given to God's people, to the saints of the Most High. And his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. That's the part of all these prophecies we enjoy thinking about. And we should anticipate that, recognize that, you know, there will be some serious, difficult, agonizing trials that God will allow his people to endure at the end of the age. But the reward is beyond anything that can be imagined, anything that we could even begin to try to describe. Verse 28, Daniel says, "This is the end of the account." He says, "That's it, I'm done. That's all I got to say. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly troubled me, and my countenance changed, but I kept the matter in my heart." That's where we are. We read these prophecies, and we are greatly troubled. We're concerned. We're uncertain of just exactly what's going to happen and what it's going to mean to us. It says, my countenance changed. My outlook, my view, the way I think, it was changed. I didn't really know quite how to process all that I had seen in this vision. But I kept the matter in my heart. We keep these matters in our heart. We don't know exactly how or exactly when, but these are prophecies that Jesus gave that are important for us to understand and to recognize the possibility that they can occur in our lifetime. As we observe the upcoming holy days, we'll focus on the outcome. The kingdom of God established on earth, mankind living at peace, ruling with Jesus Christ as he rules over the earth. But the transition has to come first. We don't know exactly when. We don't know exactly how. But we are warned to be prepared for it, to be aware of it. It's our turn. Every generation, Jesus said, needed to be prepared for his return. And when he does, he will find his disciples so doing.